I'm very happy now to welcome John Block. He is staff attorney for the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. We're continuing today with our series with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So you are working on a number of things. It seems that water quality is one of the main things that is a kind of through line between all the different projects that you're doing, all the different cases that you have at the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. One thing in particular that you are working on is the situation of dairies and dairy regulations in New Mexico.
That's correct. I guess I would have to differ, though, because we also have cases dealing with air issues and things that are related to quality of life in people's communities.
Right. So water's not in every single case, but it's in many of them.
Well, water being as important as it is, it does sort of run through everything. Flows through everything, we could say.
Yes, indeed.
And in terms of the dairies, water plays an incredibly important part because in order to run the dairy, you have to have water for the animals there. And in New Mexico now, as you know, most of the dairy establishments are what they call confined animal feeding operations. So they would have about 10 times more cows than the largest number of cows in most small dairies in the United States, let's say 40 years ago, something on the order of 2,500 to 3,500 head. And they would be in about the same amount of space as the animals were back in the day when they had maybe 250, maybe 300.
So it's very different. I mean, CAFO, confined animal feeding operation, what do these look like when you go into one?
Well, it looks very much like the dairy farm that you might have seen in a picture book, only you're not going to see Elsie the cow as you did when we were kids on the Borden label. You're going to see a heck of a lot of cows in the same amount of space. They will have long rail post feeding places where all the cows will line up to feed, lots that they're standing in before they go down a path to a place where they're milked. Unlike the old days where you'd have 6, 12 stalls in a barn, for a small number of cows, let's say 50 or 25, and people would go in there twice a day, run the animals through the barn and milk the cows that needed to be milked. Now they'd have some kind of an operation that would be, for instance, a carousel where the cows come in one end and they fill the carousel and the carousel moves around and the cows are milked and constantly being replaced so that they can move that herd through and get the milking done. You know, if you have 2,500 cows and you have to milk them twice a day and you spend, let's say, 10 minutes or 12 minutes on each one getting the milk out, that's a lot of time. And it means that you're no longer an operation that's just mom, pop, and the kids. It means you've got to have a bunch of hired hands, you know, enough to get that job done, to see that the animals are fed, that the areas they're in are mucked, and that means taking out the waste, making sure the equipment that moves the waste to places to store the waste, separate the waste into liquids and solids, is working, and that the waste is moving so that it doesn't back up or accumulate somewhere. It means that in terms of the waste disposal, at the far end of things, at the same time, you're going to be taking that liquid waste and mixing it with regular, ordinary clean water and producing a nitrogen solution that you can spray onto foliage crops. So you have this kind of dynamic of input-output from the point where the animals are fed to the point where the wastewater is mixed and then discharged onto foliage crops and finally harvested, and then measurements are supposed to be made to get the nitrogen content. And this all fits back in with a larger picture of what permitted facilities are like now in the state. And I want to be clear, I don't begin with the assumption that people who operate dairies and the people who work for them have the intention of doing damage to the natural environment. They always make the point that they need clean water for their cows. You've got to, give the animals water. They and the people who work for them have to have water to drink. But what happens is, when you're running an operation, there may be various places that you can sink a well, And the big issue that permitting is concerned with is the downgradient effects of pollution of the water supply. So what I was saying is that what you have two different ways you can approach this if you have an operation and you're being pressed to produce a certain amount of capital in a certain period of time to pay back your lenders so that you can continue your operation. And in most operations, money is borrowed at the front end, and until there's money being returned from the sale of a product, you have to have money to run the operation. And so there's a cyclic borrowing of money in order to keep the operation going. Costs such as the kind that are necessary to prevent pollution are often amortized costs. They're things that, you know, are put into the expenses of an operation over a long period of time. So if you spend, you know, $500,000 on a pond that's going to be a settling pond for your waste so that you can get the liquid waste and then pump it out and use it for a fertilizer operation, that cost would be over a period of time. And when people look at these, they tend to look at the short term. They see how pressed they are to pay back their loans. And the tendency, of course, is to try to find a way that's most cost effective in the short term. And I would say that what one needs to do is to look very carefully at the long-term costs of cleaning up a polluted area over a 10 or 15-year period versus the cost that you would have amortized in putting a double-lined leak detection system in with your settling pond. And you don't see that happening a lot, but you do see many operations in the state have gone to liners. The big problem is that historically, the last time there was a survey that was done, I think around 2009, 2010 by NMED, about 57% of the dairies in the state had caused pollution. And when the legislature acted in 2009 to require new regulations for dairies and for the copper industry, and perhaps other industries is the way that section of the Water Quality Control Act reads, they shifted their model from permitting pollution to preventing pollution. And that's a very important distinction. Historically, not just in the state of New Mexico, but throughout the United States under EPA regulations, the notion is that pollution can be permitted and that if you have a large enough area of water, for instance, or the air or soil, that dilution is the solution to pollution. That by spreading it around, you thin it out and you eliminate the in-your-face problems that it creates. So here we have historically had an approach that's not dissimilar to other places where we were permitting pollution, but the legislature decided in 2009 to pass a change in the Water Quality Control Act for dairies and copper that required the creation of preventative programs. And that's what's been done. There's now a set of regulations that govern the permitting of dairy facilities, and the existing regulations, which aren't under challenge, but we'll get to that later, basically set out a structure that's based on an input-output model. Much as you put something into one end of the cow and it comes out the other end, and we know how that comes out, you also get milk. So the cow is like a little machine for the dairy farmer, but it's a living machine, and it has to be maintained, has to be cared for, otherwise the thing that produces your goods isn't going to be doing that for you, and then you're going to be losing money. So you've got all these little units of production that are stacked up, and what you want to know is what's going through that system in order to make sure that the waste is not escaping. And so by requiring flow metering of the waste that's leaving the areas where the cows are, the stalls that they're in, the milking parlor area, wherever the waste is being collected, and going through to the collection pond, and then ultimately being pumped out, mixed with water, being put onto a crop, and then in the end harvested, if you assay the end product for its nitrogen count, and you've kept track of everything along the way, you can do what in physics is called a mass balance, and you can make sure that nothing is escaping the property. Okay. Now, of course, it's not going to be perfect. So in addition to that, you want to have monitoring wells, and you need at least three wells to establish the gradient, because we live on a three-dimensional planet, not a two-dimensional one. Otherwise, of course, you might be able to just have two wells. But because there's curvature, you have to have three. And you want to establish the flow pattern. And you want to have the wells in a location that is clearly able to intercept any pollutants that may be getting into the groundwater. And the purpose there would be to take steps to remedy the situation at that point of withdrawal, so to speak. And that's been our historic way of viewing this, that the place of pollution, if it's a point of withdrawal and a possible place for the future use of drinking water, it has to be protected. And that's what the regulations are designed to do.
One of the things that I think is very interesting, one of the many things that's interesting in what you're saying, is this question of long-term and short-term thinking. So the farmer doesn't have as much of an incentive to look at the long-term, unless there's regulation, as that person does the short-term. But there's also the question of who's responsible for the long-term cleanup. I mean, one of the things that we've seen in New Mexico, we've seen all over the country, is an industry will produce waste, the waste will contaminate an area, and then the government cleans it up and the industry isn't responsible.
That's very true. And here, it is interesting. You know, historically, agriculture has been a family business. And, you know, there's no denying that there are families in New Mexico who own dairy operations. The thing is that it's moved way beyond what it was when I lived in Vermont, and you knew, you know, when I had a law practice in Putney and I knew people who needed help who were farmers and they ran small dairying operations and they had 25, 50, 75, maybe even as much as 100 head. That's very, very different from 2,500 to 3,500. Scale of the operation. You may have everybody in your family involved in it, but you're also going to have a lot of people that you have to hire to do the work, and it really is a industrial enterprise. It's moved beyond the classic kind of organic character that a farm has and that most of us have as a picture in our mind when we think of a dairy farm. Lovely black and white cows on a hillside, you know, maybe going down the path with the bell ringing. And you don't think much about the long-term consequences. The reality is, for the people that run these operations, they are pinched too. And again, I'm not unsympathetic with that, but I think that, you know, when you're in a situation where you have to establish what size bond is going to be left with the state in case there's a cleanup, how long monitoring will take place to make sure the cleanup is complete, what kind of systems are going to be in place to prevent pollution, to monitor the flow of pollutants, to make sure that before the pollution ever gets to the property line, which is, by the way, point of compliance, and that's a whole different approach to monitoring, where you say that you're going to monitor at the edge of the property line. Well, then maybe too late. So we have this system set up with all these checks and balances, and it does make it, you know, more difficult for a farming operation, a dairy operation. But that isn't to say that a lender wouldn't be sympathetic, because the lender in many other states has lender liability. And that's something here, you know, if the dairy industry continues to push to do away with the regulations, maybe then the way to control it is to just create lender liability and make the bankers decide whether they get any money in order to do their operations or not.
What is lender liability?
Lender liability is when, if you have a problem with pollution and nobody to clean it up, you look to the lender who advanced the money to the polluter and say they knew or should have known that pollution was going to take place, and therefore they share in the liability for creating it. And there are states who've adopted that kind of a policy.
So where are we at with dairy regulation right now? I mean, as you said, in 2009, we passed some regulations that we passed some laws that changed the fundamental perspective from remediation to prevention. Are people complying?
Well, just briefly for your listeners who may not have heard our first conversation a while back, or perhaps as exciting as this news was, it slipped their minds. The regulations were passed through a process in 2010. The dairy industry appealed them. We went into negotiations with the industry, and at the end of 2011, a new set of regulations, which is the current ones, went into effect, and they've been in effect since. The problem is less a question of are the people that would be the dairy industry obeying the regulations than whether NMED has the resources and the will to enforce the regulations.
NMED being New Mexico Environment Department.
Thank you. That's correct. I was going to interpolate that in just a second. So what we have then, to answer your question, is a set of regulations that were initially passed in 2011 at the beginning, and then they were going through a process of renegotiation, and the negotiated ones, which theoretically settled all issues for the dairy industry because they signed off on a withdrawal of their complaint in the Court of Appeals that said all their issues had been settled by the new set of regulations, they were pretty much, no sooner was the ink dry from the archives in December 31, 2011, roll into the next year in 2012, and their lobbyists were already setting up appointments with NMED, letting them know these regulations were no good and they wanted to get rid of them. And what they're going after is the requirement for liners, the requirement for monitoring wells, the requirement for having accurate calibrated flow meters to monitor the flow of waste, and the requirement at the end of the process for having people who are properly educationally certified to do nutrient management plans, actually doing the plans that monitor how the waste is being disposed of. In other words, this would effectively destroy any ability to have a pollution prevention system. And it would throw everything back into the situation where when the pollution started coming off the site, the question would be who's responsible. And usually the polluter says, well, I was following the regulations. So if you have regulations that are worthless, then, you know, it's a question as to whether there's going to be liability or not. And I think that what's common between the push that we're seeing from the industry on this in the dairy area and what was done in the copper area is this desire to move from being concerned with the point of withdrawal as if it would be a place for future use of water to point of compliance, pushing it to the edge of the property line and therefore making far less protection for the human and natural environment, because the pollution can advance much, much further toward the general public before any interception might take place.
Now, what does all this mean and what has it actually resulted in so far? I mean, what kind of groundwater pollution are we seeing from the dairy industry?
Well, for one thing, we really can't tell. We only know what kind of data was available 2009, 2010 that the New Mexico Environment Department collected then through its Groundwater Quality Bureau. And there is a spreadsheet that, you know, was generally available to the public because it was released in the hearing process on the first set of dairy regs. And as far as I know, they've done nothing to reassess any of this.
But so, what did it tell us then?
Well, it told us then that there were at least about 57% of the dairies in the state were polluting. I believe that's what the data showed.
And that pollution was nitrogen and stuff like that going into the water?
Well, you have, you know, animal waste getting into the water supply, right, into the aquifer. And then it's monitored in the groundwater monitoring wells. Whether it's reached the point of leaving is something else. And I think that so far we've been lucky. If there are places, and I'm sure there are some in the state, that have had the pollution hit the water supply, those places now have public water supplies as an alternative to private wells. But as far as I know, the private individuals were never compensated for the loss of their wells. So if you look in the area down in Dairy Row, which is south of Las Cruces, and runs from Mesquite through Vado and down to Anthony, which is Anthony, New Mexico on one side of the line and Anthony, Texas on the other, there is a map that was produced by the, I believe, the dairy industry environmental analyst that shows the scope of the plume of pollution, and it goes all the way down to Anthony. And at this point, what NMED has proposed to do is to agree with the dairy industry's proposal to do nothing more, to just wait and let it naturally attenuate and then look at it again over time. We had petitioned to have a hearing on that on behalf of some people in Anthony who were concerned. And although we were granted a hearing, there's been no forward motion at this point in scheduling it or anything else. It's just been sitting there and, I believe, waiting for the attorney on the other side to respond to the request to meet and set up a schedule to have a hearing. Meanwhile, of course, you know, in a sense, the plan that they had is going forward because nothing else is being done. I believe at the time they made it public, the industry indicated there was a well or two more that they were going to put in because some well had not been effective or was not giving what they considered reliable data. But it isn't clear that that particular approach will be effective in the long term. And what's lost in the meantime? Well, to whatever extent the aquifer is contaminated, that's water that can't be used for other purposes. Perhaps it could be used for industrial purposes, I don't know. But it means that people are put on public water supplies, and unless and until that same pollution hits the point where of withdrawal for those public water supplies, you know, people are being protected because they have water to drink and they have it at a different source. But as I pointed out when I started speaking about this, the people who lost the use of their wells, I don't believe that those people are ever compensated for that.
Well, and also, I mean, in the big picture, if you've got polluted aquifers in a desert state, that's that much less water that the state can use for various purposes.
That's certainly true. And if it's an aquifer that where all of the water rights have been parceled out already, then you are SOL, as they say, because where are you going to get any water? You know, and now suddenly the water's been polluted by somebody who shares the water with you. And the way it works here, if they have senior rights, they get to go on doing what they're doing. And, you know, the state engineer, as far as I know, has yet to ever take a step to do anything about water quality, even though that is one of the things they're supposed to be looking at. And they're supposed to be looking at the impacts in terms of the health and well-being of the state whenever they issue permits. I don't believe they've ever gone back and said to somebody, well, look, you're destroying the water quality here, so you're going to have to stop what you're doing. The way each one of the agencies here looks at it is the old saying, the apocryphal words of Wernher von Braun, I just shoot them up, I don't know where they come down, it's not my department. So the engineer is deals with quantity, NMED deals with quality. If there's somebody is spraying something out into the air, oh, well, that's the air department's problem. You see, so even though it might be a mist that they're spraying, oh, that becomes air pollution, you know, and oh, you got to go to the air department. And this remains a problem not just in New Mexico, by the way. This is a problem all over the country. The myth that we've really cleaned up pollution, when in many cases what we've done is we've channeled it into other places. And whenever the pollutant sources are of a mixed kind, and I'll give you an example up at Lanel, where they've got a plume of chromium and they want to get rid of the chromium. So NMED gives them permission to spray the chromated water over the land and over a huge area of land. And then if one is trying to monitor these things on behalf of the downstream public, you find that, well, then it becomes a question, well, should that go to solid waste now? Because they're irrigating the ground. And or should hazardous waste come in? Or is it a water issue? And, of course, each one of the agencies being overworked, understaffed, underpaid, they are absolutely thrilled at the prospect that what was a water issue now becomes some other department's issue.
And they're not seeing the thing as a whole system where all of these parts interact and solid becomes liquid and liquid becomes gas and goes back again.
You know, and it's interesting. That's one of the things I've noticed when I listen to other programs of yours, that you do remark on that. You know, the notion that things need to be treated, I don't like the word holistically because it has other connotations, but from a physics point of view, you know, there's no free lunch. It's one single entity, the Earth, one single system. And to the extent that we pump carbon into the atmosphere and pour animal excrement into the water supply, you know, and sow the soil with our garbage instead of using composting and separating and many other things that we can do, and inject oil waste into the deep layers of the earth when, you know, the liquids could be separated and cleaned before anything like that ever takes place. It's a way in which people are just not paying any attention to the big picture. It's like that difference between short and long-term investment, you know. You're going to make an investment where you get a profit in 5 years versus you get a profit in 10. Chances are most investors are going to grab the five-year plan and ignore the fact that, oh, and by the way, if you go for the 10-year option, a couple of your grandchildren may be born deformed. They're not going to think about it. And even if they did, they may just write it off because they're going to look at what's the probability, what's the real risk factor that that's going to happen, and that if it does happen, then it happens to me and my family. And, you know, these things remain problematic in all of the environmental schemes we have. And that's why at the Law Center, each of us is doing a variety of things, and you've happened to seize on the water. But as I said, I mean, we deal with all kinds of issues from, you know, expansion of airports to air pollution in the South Valley. I mean, we have our hands there to try to assist people, not just by lawyering in these agencies, but teaching them to go out and do things for themselves that will help them change things and help them combat these issues.
So where do we stand right now in terms of the dairy industry? I mean, what it sounds like is we've got regulations, they're not really being enforced, there's no will to enforce them. What is your role at the New Mexico Environmental Law Center? What is the role of the public? Where are we?
Well, first I would be clear that I can't say that there's no enforcement. What I can say is that it's certainly the case that what's taking place is not taking place at the level that it did under the previous administration.
In terms of enforcement.
In terms of enforcement. In terms of permitting, that may also be the case, because what they've done is basically held up the permitting while the dairy industry's rules are pending. So people are running on the permits that they had before. And if the particular dairy got the permit in time, so many days, 100 days or whatever it is, then they get to run on the permit. If not, then they have to get a permit. So it reduces the number of permits they have to issue. And the idea that they have is, oh, well, if the regulations change and they no longer need liners and da-da-da-da-da, then it would be unfair to impose these things on them. But what's missing in the thinking is, what's the net effect on water pollution throughout the state by doing it that way? And yes, what's the state of things? The state is that the dairy industry has challenged the regulations, and that sometime in the next, you know, 1 to 4 months or 5 months, these things are going to come up. And when they do, you know, the chances are that the current Water Quality Control Commission will give the industry what it wants. And just as they did with the copper industry. And when that happens, there will be very few protections of groundwater from the dairy industry's pollution.
And at that point, is there any recourse that the public has?
Well, of course, you know, I look at these things not just as somebody that's serving a client population, but also as a citizen who's concerned. And, you know, I have that same view along with Bill Olson, who's been helping me as an expert on some of these issues. Bill used to be the groundwater quality chief. And, you know, what we share is a longer-term interest in the environmental health of the state, and particularly the health of the groundwater, because you can't live, you can't be productive without a water supply. So not only can't individuals grow and prosper and live, but you can't have crops. You know, there's so many things that are connected to water. Water, without water, there is no life for us. So, yeah, there's a longer-term concern, and I think What will happen then is, unless the legislature moved to bar it, that there would start to be more and more private lawsuits against dairies, and that as the pollution spreads and begins to hit people's water supplies, there will be private legal actions, you know, in which people are seeking recompense from the dairy industry. And I think at some point, certainly if enough of those things take place, the lenders will start to become very chary. Because, you know, if I'm bringing a litigation, I certainly would want to start to include the banks, the insurance companies, and anybody else who knew or should have known that, you know, under the current situation that pollution would take place and that, you know, it was a reasonable thing to do something to prevent it.
So what you're looking at really, from my perspective, is a model where instead of preventing illness, you're letting the body become ill and then trying to treat it with all the suffering and expense that goes along with that.
I would go even further. I would say it's more like an epidemic such as Ebola. And what the industry seems to be hell-bent on doing at this point is creating a situation where there will be an epidemic of pollution from dairies. And the only ones that won't be polluting are the ones that have bothered to get with the requirements and put in liners and maintain all their metering and do the work even though they don't have to. And of course there are going to be people like that. They're just like any other group of people. There are responsible dairy owners. There are people who really do care, who are true stewards. The problem is that given the realities, the economic realities, there are going to be many people who want to avoid any of that, and that's the position they seem to be, you know, hell-bent on pushing through in terms of changing the regs. So I would say what happens then is you get an epidemic of pollution, and you and I both know from reading the daily newspaper, once you get an epidemic, it's a lot harder to stem the tide, and many, many more people will be damaged. The question is what will happen, and I think ultimately it will be to the extreme detriment of the dairy industry itself that they will start to suffer real economic damage in the long run. And at some point, as I say, you know, it will be less likely that lenders and insurance companies will give them what they need to keep functioning.
We're talking to John Block of the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Now, what we have here, and this is another theme that keeps coming up as we talk to people from the Environmental Law Center, is on the one hand, you've got a kind of alliance between government and industry, so the government is not really acting to protect the people as much as it is to promote industries. And there's reasons and excuses and rationalizations for that, but the bottom line is that there's nobody out there protecting us from these kinds of pollution except organizations like New Mexico Environmental Law Center and others. Who's actually working on these issues here in New Mexico?
Well, I would, of course, Mary Charlotte, make a distinction, as lawyers always do, between the law center being the advocate and the clients. We work for a variety of organizations, and in terms of the Dairy Coalition, it's currently formed of the Rio Grande chapter of the Sierra Club, a group called Caballo Concerned Citizens, Mesquite Community Action, Rio Vaya Concerned Citizens, Lee County Concerned Citizens, and Amigos Bravos, Friends of the Wild Rivers. And you know, of course, of the Sierra Club and Amigos Bravos probably from speaking with people in the organizations, or just being aware of the work they do around the state. But both the Sierra Club and Amigos have been in the forefront of issues involving damages to resources from mining, milling, you know, dairy industry, chemical industry, etc. Mesquite Community Action, and that's the work of Arturo Uribe, were involved in trying to deal with the pollution from the Helena Chemical Company. And have been working on the dairy issue as well. Lee County is a group of folks there who've been concerned with dairy pollution. Rio Vaya is down near Anthony, and that's a group of people concerned with the pollution there. Caballo is people concerned with the pollution in the area there. So you have what you'd call small citizens groups. And again, you know, one of the big roles that the Law Center plays is we represent those people in the administrative proceedings, which are often difficult for people to get involved in. You're forced to go into what's called a quasi adjudicatory proceeding, a complicated mass of verbiage, which means it's like going into court and you stand there in front of the judge, which in this case is a commission of people, and you got to have an expert, or you've got to be prepared to present technical testimony. You have to file it at a certain time, has to look a certain way. You get subject to what's called cross-examination, which means skilled lawyers get to grill you if they want to on what you're presenting. So for ordinary citizens or groups of citizens, the effective thing is to find a place where they can get representation. And one of the few that will do it in state proceedings, maybe even the only one in the state, is the Law Center. And, you know, we're concerned mostly with environmental justice. And that means the way in which people are disempowered by the system when there are environmental issues and their environment is being damaged. And so we try to reset that balance to some degree, but we work against incredible odds in doing that. In this case, I would also say, again, emphasizing, I can't say that, you know, the regulations that were established under the state statute called the Water Quality Control Act, which created the commission, the Water Quality Control Commission, but also gave the Environment Department the enforcement authority and set up a requirement that regulations be established to preserve water quality in the state by the commission, and then they be enforced by various agencies that have authority over those things. So I can't say that that's not taking place. All I can say is that I know that it's not at the scale it was with the previous administration, because I dealt with the previous one, and that the problem remains as severe. In terms of the citizens' groups, what we do is we file for them with the commission, the Water Quality Control Commission, a notice of intent to present technical testimony. And we have two experts, a woman named Kathy Martin, who's an expert on liners and other issues. She's a professional engineer licensed in New Mexico. And we have William Olson, who was the head of the Groundwater Quality Bureau. And the two of them put together their testimony with supporting exhibits, and then that's filed with the commission and the other parties. And then that will all get to be considered when there is a hearing on this proposal to essentially gut the regulations. And what we're in the stage we're in right now is preparing rebuttal testimony. That's due on Friday. And then there's a few weeks gap, and theoretically the hearing is supposed to begin on the 9th in Roswell. As I know you know, I don't know if your listeners know, we filed an objection to that, and we believe that the law requires very clearly that the hearing has to be held in Santa Fe. Comment sessions, of course, could be held elsewhere, but the technical hearings need to be held here under the Water Quality Control Act. So we brought that up as an issue, and that'll get resolved, and if the court doesn't agree with us, we'll probably be in Roswell for at least 4 days, maybe 5 days of hearings on these regs beginning December 9th. If the court does agree, then everything is going to have to be rescheduled to some future date. But that gives your listeners a, I was going to say your readers, but your listeners, it gives your listeners an idea of the way these things work, and that there are laws under which regulations are passed, and the Water Quality Control Commission is administering the laws, but under the laws, they have to, you know, have regulations, and regulations can be proposed by anybody. Often they're proposed by the New Mexico Environment Department. And then once they're placed before the commission through what I describe as the quasi-adjudicatory process, they're then vetted, and then finally, after all the evidence has been presented, all the arguments been made, the commission makes the decision up or down. They can modify what's been presented. They can change it. So it really is true that you don't know until the end exactly what you're dealing with.
One of the things that I think is really important about laws and regulations is that, let's say you've got a dairy that wants to do right by the not only the customers of the dairy, but the citizens, the residents of the area, by the water, by the aquifers. If there's a rule, they want to comply with that rule or law. But if everybody has to comply by the same one, then there's an even playing field. And I think, you know, it basically penalizes people who are doing the right thing if you don't have proper regulation.
Well, I can't disagree with that. And I think another thing to remember, and this is something that they not only teach you in law school, but if you go to get a business degree or a degree in economics, it's one of the premises, which is that for an entity, whether it's a corporation that produces widgets or a dairy that's producing milk, knowing, having certainty in advance, knowing what the regulations are, how they work, and how they'll be applied, is something that allows you to make plans. And that planning is what allows you to know how much insurance to get, how much money to borrow, etc. So it's not only something that protects the environment, but from a good business point of view, having uniform regulations that protect the environment, ensure a future, eliminate future liabilities or bring them down to a minimum, is something that will benefit the industry. And that's why, at this point, it's, as I say, it's difficult for me to understand why the industry is doing what it's doing. And I think it's short-sighted, and I think ultimately, once they realize how short-sighted it is, it may need to be brought home to them in a very unfortunate way once they get what they want. But once they learn that, I think they will change.
Well, it's also, and we've discussed this on this program at other times during the year. Often this comes up during the legislative session. If you want New Mexico to be an attractive state where people want to live, better clean than dirty.
One would think, and I think at this point you just can say amen to that, you know. It makes a lot of sense, and yet we have these persistent problems. You know, if you read the price book, The Orphaned Land, it's like a catalog of all of the pollution issues in the state. And one of the things that was good under the previous administration is that it seemed as if, you know, it wasn't perfect, but there was this general commitment to deal with these problems and at the same time, you know, try to continue to have economic growth. And I think that, as I said before, I think that whether it's in the long term or not, that eventually these issues will be dealt with, because they are ultimately survival issues. You can't have a future for your children and your grandchildren if you don't have clean water, clean air, and clean land. And if you don't do the kind of planning that's land use planning, long-term land use planning that plans for sustainability of communities.
We also haven't gotten into issues of worker rights and animal rights and things that often come up around large-scale industrial operations involving animals.
You know, there was a recent event that went viral showing a dairy here in New Mexico with the cows being beaten with chains and picked up with a forklift. A dairy engaging in the kind of practices that don't seem to make real sense when the cow, as I've described it before, is a unit of production. You know, even if you put aside the cow as a human creature, well, it's not a human creature, it's a cow. So, you know, you want to think about what are the basic rights of all creatures and what it means to abuse an animal. It's hard to imagine that somebody that uses animals for production would engage in the kind of abuse that was shown in that video. And so, of course, that remains an issue. And that's another thing. You know, the dairies have been pushing a law to stop anybody from reporting on this, from videoing any of it. Workers from, you know, whistleblowing these things. And again, one has to ask, like, where is the thinking there? Why is that nothing more than reactive thinking? You know, I'm going to protect what's mine. Versus, gee, having healthy, happy, well-cared-for animals is what gives me my wealth. And so I need to protect them. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me, because there are issues of worker safety and worker health and worker pay that are still really only beginning to be dealt with. So why would we expect animals to be treated decently if the human beings aren't being treated decently? I think, you know, it's an industry that needs to take a long, hard look at itself, and then unfortunately what it's been doing is spending its money trying to lower costs in a very short-sighted way.
I often wonder if you added up all the money that an industry paid to lobbyists, whether those wouldn't buy an awful lot of pond liners.
You know, that's hard to say, but one of the things that you see again and again, particularly now that we're looking at the testimony that's been pre-filed for this hearing, is the failure to deal with what economists call the external costs. And the pollution of the environment, harm to individuals, let's say they lose hands, arms, damage to their legs or shoulders so that they can't work, they're on the dole, the destruction of your own property, damage to the animals. All of these things tend to be shifted into external costs, when in reality, you know, even putting in a liner gets to be non-externalized. They get to treat that as cost of operations, so that's something, of course, you can amortize and deduct from your taxes. So the way the law is set up, they do get some benefits already. They already get some incentives under the tax law to do the right thing. But as I say, I think that the drive becomes for higher and higher profitability to insulate oneself, so when the market goes bad, you can continue to roll over into the next cycle. And when people are confronted with those things, I think not all of them, but some of them, tend to do very bad things to the workers, to the environment, and to the animals, all of whom should be part of the concept of their stewardship.
John Block is a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. And tomorrow is the last segment in our four-part series with them. They can be found on the web at nmenvirolaw.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte, for the opportunity to address some of these issues and raise the level of understanding of your listeners.